You're listening to The Review, first broadcast on the 27th of July 2013 on Monocle 24.
Hello and welcome to The Review, your weekly preview and review of the arts here on Monocle 24, coming to you from Studio One here at Midori House with me, Emma Nelson and Andrew Muller.
Coming up on today's programme, we'll get the lowdown on the hottest new art shows in New York with William Smith, editor at Art in America magazine.
But today, the market and capitalism have already colonized craftsmanship and artisanship, and I think that's the moment that a lot of these artists are responding to.
We'll also be asking the comic and the comedy journalist James Mullinger to give his take on this year's Just for Laughs Festival. He'll be joining us live on the line from Montreal.
And if you're contemplating taking in a film under the stars, look no further. We'll be here to guide you through the world's best outdoor cinemas.
Try Film on the Rocks in Denver. Screenings take place in the stunning Red Rocks Amphitheatre. From mid-August, they'll be showing the Rocky Horror Picture Show.
Plus, we welcome back the graphic designer, DJ and former member of Lemon Jelly, Fred Deakin, to share some music with us. So there's lots to look forward to this week on The Review here on Monocle 24. So we share our cultural weeks. We have a week of opposites, don't we, Mr. Muller? From large scale to perhaps slightly smaller. What's your week involved?
My week has involved mostly being here, as usual, doing programmes in the evening. The cultural highlight of, well, actually not this week, but last week, was playing with my own band before a very small crowd of bewildered people in Leytonstone.
How very small?
Comprised mostly of the other bands on the bill.
Right.
Frankly. It wasn't the greatest show, I think, we've played due to some somewhat erratic sound PA issues.
Was it one of those situations
Big night for fans of our bass player, though.
Did you want
we
to
couldn't
pick
hear things? Anything else?
Oh no! Did you want to pick things? How do you pick yourself up and dust yourself down after that?
Drink is usually involved.
Fine, lovely.
But we are playing again on Sunday night, however, at the Brixton Windmill, where the PA is exemplary.
Tickets still available?
I believe so.
I thought they might be. My week was the absolute opposite to that. I had my first experience of a Wagner opera at the Proms. So we had sellout at the Royal Albert Hall, 2.5 hours of solid brilliant playing, and I fell in love with Wagner. It was the oddest thing that I'd ever experienced. I thought I would sit there in a boiling, boiling hot concert hall. I mean, no air conditioning, thousands, hundreds of people in there, and sat there and was absolutely riveted. And it was one of those concert performances, so you didn't even have much to look at. You just followed the libretto and off you went.
Did they do the hit from Apocalypse Now?
They didn't do the hit. That was the other one. The Flying Lady with Horns is Die Walküre. I only saw Das Rheingold. But that was one of the four of the whole of the Ring cycle that's playing at the Proms this year in celebration of Wagner's bicentenary. It's had amazing reviews, and quite rightly so. It was one of those events that you go and you think, actually, this was... People will be writing about this in about 30, 40 years' time.
Has it inspired you to become one of those people who go to Bayreuth and sit on a wooden stick or whatever it is for about a week while the whole thing gets played?
It did cross my mind, which was really astonishing that Bayreuth might be one day a destination to go. But I think you have to be in a certain frame of mind. You perhaps a drink needs to be taken before, during and after. But it was truly brilliant. It really was. So if there are any tickets available, I think I'll be trying to cram in another one tomorrow night. That's only 260 minutes long, so not so bad.
It's nice to know that Wagner and my band have something in common, though. Drink is required.
Brought together on Monocle 24 as well, on The Review. So we're starting this week with something a bit different. We're getting out of the studio because summer shows are on full blast in New York's galleries, and we wanted to find out more about what's hot there.
We asked William Smith, editor at Art in America magazine, to recommend three exhibitions that should not, in his opinion, be missed. He met Monocle's Pauline Eiferman at Green Naftali in Chelsea to talk about Freak Out, a show he says is representative of what's happening this summer in the New York art scene.
So right now we're on the 8th floor, I believe, of probably a former industrial building in Chelsea on 26th Street in New York. We're standing in Freak Out, which is the summer show organized by Green Naftali Gallery. And I wanted to bring you here because I think this is a great example, first of all, of what a summer show at a New York gallery looks like. It's kind of all over the place, a little bit rambunctious. There are emerging artists, let's say emerged artists, kind of thrown together. But more specifically, I think Green Naftali is an interesting place because It has a sort of reputation and cachet, sort of like a more intellectual gallery than most that you'll find in Chelsea. And they often take risks featuring younger artists, both from New York and from around the world. And their programming sometimes looks more like what you would find on the Lower East Side than amongst like the blue chip galleries in Chelsea. One of the things you see now happening a lot amongst younger artists is an emphasis on craft and what craft and artisanship might mean today. And a lot of the objects that you can see around here look, I mean, some of them look almost like outsider art, constructed with like very simple materials, with a very casual, shrugged off air to them. But craft, I think, has a very sophisticated position in this work. It's not just naive outsider craftsmanship, but a kind of conceptual program. I mean, right now we can see a carpet on the floor by a young Austrian artist named Verena Dangler. And I bring up this carpet because it sort of exemplifies what I mean by like the position of craft. So the motif on the carpet looks, I mean, it's almost like a child could have done it, let's say. There are sort of scribbled lines, there are big swirls everywhere, very expressionistic, idiosyncratic, eccentric kinds of forms. But if you look closely at the carpet, you can see that it is not really handmade looking at all. It has the finish and texture of something that you could find on the cheap rack at IKEA. And I think that's important, this kind of move between handmade looking designs and motifs and a manufactured finished look. Because artisanship and craftsmanship today, maybe in the past it would have meant a place where you could kind of experiment and make something at home on your own. But today, you know, the market and capitalism have already colonized craftsmanship and artisanship. We buy, you know, artisanal bread at Wendy's, and we shop for crafts on Etsy. And I think that's the moment that a lot of these artists are responding to.
And can you show us another piece that you like or you think is representative?
So a number of artists in this exhibition are dealing with digital technologies in various ways. And a great example of this is this work called Entropy Wrangler by an artist named Ian Chang. What we're looking at on the screen is a very bizarre, gravity-free world of 3D imagery. Where random stuff is just floating around. We see images of bodies, we see what look like dining utensils, tools, everything sort of twittering, twitching, fluttering, and there's a soundtrack that seems to be playing this sort of muffled sound of things hitting a ground and then having the ground dissolve all around them. Chang describes this piece as a live simulation of infinite duration. So this will just go on forever, and presumably none of these exact configurations of objects will repeat. What's interesting about the work is that it evolves and develops over time, or really it's probably more accurate to say that it devolves. I mean, the principle animating this 3D world of Chang's is entropy. So all of the forms that he has programmed into it are breaking down, losing energy, losing structure over the course of this simulation. There's a lot of overlap between this exhibition and some exhibitions that you'll see in museums around New York City at the moment. A number of these artists have work at Expo One, the big show at PS1. We're also at the Whitney Museum. So this is why it's a very influential kind of gallery. They're willing to take risks on younger artists, and you see that sort of trickle through the whole New York art ecology later on.
We leave Green Naftali on 26th Street and climb up the stairs to the High Line. There, William gives me his second recommendation.
There's a solo exhibition by an artist named Simon Fujiwara on view now at Andrea Rosen Gallery on 24th Street in Chelsea. The exhibition features a work that Fujiwara premiered at the Sharjah Biennial in the United Arab Emirates. And it deals with a photograph that he found or really half remembered. And the photograph depicts his own mother in the arms of a Lebanese man coming out of the ocean. And the work is interesting because it represents Fujiwara's attempt to reconstruct both the photograph and his own memories and reactions to it. So the main component is a theatrical stage with documentation surrounding it of Fujiwara's attempt to recast the photograph. So he found a woman who resembled his mother and found a man who resembled his memory of the man in the photograph, and then tried to restage it. Although in this case, it was the man in the arms of the mother. And so he calls the piece in reference to a Pieta, which is that configuration. It's an intriguing piece that weaves together a document from the artist's own autobiography, his own past, with larger themes and narratives about global travel, about intersections of cultures from the East and the West, concerns with sexuality, race, and globalization.
And why did you particularly want to include this show in this list? How do you feel about it personally?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think it's a great example of a larger tendency in contemporary art to stage reenactments of documentary work, and also to use found objects as a way of sparking different kinds of personal expressive memories. So it's a kind of detached reflection on self that I think is a really good way to think about self-expression and reflection in our present era, where you're not necessarily pouring some romantic feeling out onto the table in a new form, but sort of responding to these documents and images that surround you and which structure your memory and your feelings.
And the third show you wanted to mention today.
Well, I think one of the most ambitious art projects happening in New York this summer is by Paul McCarthy, the sort of patriarch, to use a sort of apt word in this case, of the Los Angeles art scene. It's been a kind of spring-summer festival of McCarthy's work. His gallery, Hauser and Worth, has mounted three separate exhibitions at their commercial spaces, and many of those have been related to a large-scale, total work of art, immersive environment that McCarthy constructed at the Park Avenue Armory, which is a former armory. So imagine just an expansive, open space in the middle of Manhattan's Upper East Side. McCarthy has filled it with his own version of Disney's magical kingdom. There is an enchanted forest that is sort of lit in garish artificial lighting, and there's a reconstruction of McCarthy's childhood home inside. But the sort of main effect of it is a multi-channel video showing, I guess, 7 hours of footage of McCarthy's reimagining of Snow White and the Seven Dwarves as white snow. It's a debauched frat party, house party, with this fairy tale princess being sort of cavorted over by a cast of seven, or I guess it's nine in this case, fat, ugly dwarves in college sweatshirts. And everyone is covered in alcohol and smeared with chocolate frosting. And it really is an NC-17 movie. They're not letting children inside to see this. So McCarthy's vision sometimes can be very like sexually explicit, very grotesque, abject, I think would be the right word. But he doesn't just force actors to do this. He's right there himself, starring in the movie as Walt Paul, his sort of vision of himself mixed with maybe his father, mixed with Walt Disney, mixed with Hitler maybe a little bit. So staging this extravagant piece. So I think this is McCarthy's moment, because some of the silliness and the comedy and the over-the-top garishness of his project can mask the sort of underlying thought and intelligence of it. And I think now is the time when people are hopefully going to recognize that. He's also an artist who has long maintained a teaching practice. So he's mentored and taught whole generations of artists coming out of LA. And he's important for that reason as well.
That was William Smith, editor of Art in America magazine, speaking there to Pauline Eiferman in New York.
You're listening to The Review on Monocle 24. Up next, Nelly Gotcheva with her weekly guide to cultural happenings around the world.
Culture on Monocle 24 is untouchable. Go on, just try and do it. Try and grab a handful of the top-grade cultural radio that we're dishing out and see if you can touch it. Well, exactly. Luckily, though, you can feel it. Feel the passion of the unusually button-bright presentation.
It's a fantastic contrast, and it's one of those ones that ask you to look at the brushwork, to look just at the canvas.
Feel the craftsmanship in the breathtaking live Midori House sessions.
You know, I consider myself an entertainer, so I'm really about communication. I'm not really about expressing myself so much as trying to communicate with people and bring them to tears or bring them to laughter or what have you.
Feel the lovingly hand-stitched production, and most of all, feel the love of art.
It's there and it's true, but it's really only a small part of his work.
Feel the love of fiction, feel the love of film, feel the love of music, feel the love generally.
It is the most extraordinary collation of works that you would never normally see together.
Why not invite me round? Culture with Robert Bound is a well-behaved house guest and a joy to entertain.
That's Culture with Robert Bound, premiering every Monday at 1900 hours UK time, right here on Monocle 24.
Welcome back to The Review. Now, if you're currently kicking your heels in Toronto and like your conceptual art, or if you're mooching about in Melbourne and fancy going to see a film, or, however, if you like photography and you happen to be in Hong Kong, then Nelly Gotcheva is here to help with a look ahead to the pick of this weekend's cultural events around the world.
In Toronto, the Power Plant Art Space is hosting Postscript, Writing After Conceptual Art. It features a collection of text-based art stretching back to the 1960s. It explores how language interacts with society and culture. More than 50 conceptual artists participate in the project. We suggest you check out a mural of Indian ink by Fiona Banner entitled 1066. The exhibition is on until the 2nd of September. For more information, go to thepowerplant.org. The Melbourne International Film Festival kicked off earlier this week. On the programme are over 300 films from around the world. We recommend for Saturday The Patient Stone, directed by Kabul-born Atiq Rahimi. It features a captivating performance by Iranian actress Golshifteh Farahani. In her role as a young wife of a comatose husband, living in difficult circumstances in a war-torn Middle Eastern village. The Melbourne International Film Festival is at various venues across the city until the 11th of August. In London, Simon Lee Gallery hosts In Lines and Realignments, a group exhibition of seven Brazil-based artists. On show are installations by American Marcius Galan and Brazilian Cildo Meirelles. In 2008, Meirelles became the first Brazilian artist to be given a full retrospective by the Tate. In Lines and Realignments is at the Simon Lee Gallery until the 28th of August. A new photo exhibition entitled All About Hong Kong is currently at the AO Vertical Art Space in the city. 10 local and international photographers explore different aspects of Hong Kong, tracking the city's history from the 1950s to the present day. Among the 80 works on display are black and white photos by Chinese film director and photographer Hao Fan, and the latest shots by the Hong Kong-based German photographer Michael Wolf. All About Hong Kong is on until the 14th of September. Lucca Summer Festival takes over the beautiful medieval Italian city of Lucca each July. And you can catch one of the closing ticketed events on Saturday night by heading to Piazza Napoleone to hear the epic sounds of Icelandic band Sigur Rós. And let's have a taste of them now. It's Sigur Rós with Izyaki. From Monocle in Toronto, I'm Nelly Gotcheva.
That was Izyaki by Sigur Rós, ending that report there by Nelly Gotcheva. You're listening to The Review on Monocle 24. It's time now for our weekly music review, and we're delighted to welcome back Fred Deacon, known as much for his graphic design and DJ work as he is for his deceptively psychedelic productions as one half of Lemon Jelly.
Fred, welcome to the show. The last time we had you on Monocle 24, you were billed, we checked in the script, as a colossus of surreal music. Is that still an accurate description of what you're up to?
Well, I can't possibly disagree with that statement. You know, I'm sure my mother would recognise me immediately from those words. Where's my son, the colossal of whatever it was?
Actually, what is a colossus of surreal music?
You're looking at it, baby.
What are you up to at the moment? Because Andrew has just billed you as a DJ and a graphic designer, but of course, Lemon Jelly is still there. Are you on a hiatus at the moment?
We're on a hiatus at the moment, yes, but we're still kind of talking about it. But we both need to be getting involved in interactive art. Nick was at Latitude with his million radios. And I've been doing spaces that you walk into and trigger with visuals and music. I'm trying to find a new way that's a kind of appropriate cutting-edge way to take music to people, kind of post-download, because downloads are so kind of shrunk compared to vinyls and even CDs.
How do you manage to... do you ever manage to bring together your graphic design and art with music?
Yeah, that's very much my intention. And I think the whole Lemon Jelly project had a very strong visual feel to it. I remember a lot of people saying to me that they discovered the music because they saw the sleeve and they went, well, what's that? And then they checked it out and then they liked it. And now, obviously, the music's got to be good. But part of the way of drawing people into it was that visual side of things.
Do you think music has, or popular music at least, has caught up with the way that people now listen to it? Because it strikes me that music has not changed terribly much as the means of consumption has.
Well, I would slightly disagree with you there. I think that the first part of your question, I would totally agree with it, which in that I think that the medium of delivery of music is not yet mature for a post-digital age. I think that the experience has been reduced and people listening to music through their phones with no kind of further engagement with the artist means that, I think Jarvis Cocker said it, music's become like a scented candle now. It's not something you hold and love. But I think music has reacted by becoming much more populist and shallow or willfully underground, and the middle ground has kind of vanished. I think current pop music really leaves me cold, and I love pop. You know, give me a good cheesy pop record, I'm never happier.
So where do you find your music now?
Junk shops, mostly. I've sworn never to buy another CD recently, I decided. Because old CDs are so horrible and they don't value at all. You know, a collection of CDs is worthless. I buy a bit online. I buy quite a lot of new vinyl online. But basically, whenever I travel anywhere, to my wife's despair, I spend a large amount of time trawling through thrift stores and junk shops and secondhand record shops. And that's kind of like a map. My record collection becomes a map of my global journeys, which is fun.
Now, you brought some... How should I describe it? Not necessarily thrift shop music, but music that perhaps I can say with confidence that Monocle 24 has never experienced before.
Good.
We often have guests who bring in one genre, one period of music, and one age of music. You, on the other hand, have brought in, well, pretty much unidentifiable kinds of music.
Well, that's my style, definitely. And the mix album I did a few years ago, The Triptych, was definitely trying to embody that, where I was saying it's all good music. Every genre has good music. You know, 99% of heavy metal probably is pretty unlistenable, but there's 1% of it that's brilliant. Well, you know, maybe I'm aligned the heavy metal genre there. Probably more like 2 or 3%.
2 or 3%, yes. Yeah. Let's give them their due.
It is a diverse collection, which appropriately, I guess, given what you were just saying about your purchasing habits, does rather look like a kind of the bag of stuff from which you would return from a garage sale being held by a lunatic clearing out his attic.
Instead of orderly, one got the impression this was stored in a carrier bag.
Indeed. Well, when I see a lunatic at a car boot sale, he's the guy I go to. He's my man.
Okay, well, let's strap ourselves in for the first one you have selected. Introduce it, if you will.
Okay, well, this is Joe Lemaire and Falouz with a Serge Gainsbourg cover that I actually discovered in Cheltenham. Jamais
Cause
Joe Lemaire there, and Flues, and Je suis venu te dire que je m'en vais. The choice of Fred Deakin, DJ, graphic designer, and one half of Lemon Jelly.
And can I just say, Emma, this fantastic French pronunciation.
Thank you very much.
Title.
It took me hours. It's a strange piece of music because I'm not sure what period it comes from.
Exactly. And
it is that very Giorgio Moroder 80s sound, which has, I mean, then subsequently, I guess, exhumed by French artists like Air and Daft Punk especially.
Exactly. And it always amazes me, how long will the current generation worship the 80s for? I mean, it started about 10 years ago. And the 80s, you know, that record could have been... If I told you it came out last week, you wouldn't argue with me, would you? And it's 30 years old.
Yeah, I would be unsurprised by either being told it came out last week or in 1985. You described it as a Serge Gainsbourg cover you found in Cheltenham, which is possibly a sentence never before uttered in the entire history of human discourse. Do you know anything about Joe Lemaire and Flues?
It's a one-hit wonder. The rest of the album is awful. and I found it in a record shop in Cheltenham, which was staffed by these two young boys.
Where's this going, Fred?
don't worry. I think it was their dad's record shop, actually.
And
I
or came, just their dad's record collection.
I think it was also their dad's record collection, because I picked up a single by a Cheltenham band when I was there, and I'm pretty sure it was their dad's band. But these two kids were just having a ball just on a Saturday afternoon, flicking through Jam 7 inches and, you know, discovering all these amazing nuggets and then thrilling their friends with them. And the thing, I've never worked in a record shop, and I was very jealous.
That was one of your dreams, wasn't it, Andrew Muller? You always thought that you could get girls if you worked in a record shop.
Yeah, and I did work in a record shop when I was a kid. God, no. And then I became a rock journalist for the same reason. That doesn't work either.
No, of course it doesn't. Let's move on to your next choice, Fred. This is The Free Design.
Yes.
And I have no idea what this is about. Please help us.
Okay. Well, The Free Design were this kind of vocal, easy listening group that Enoch Light discovered. And I came to them, like a lot of people, through Stereo Lab, who named an EP after them. I'm a massive Stereo Lab fan, and so I kind of logged that and bought every record by them that I found. And they come from that time when there was kind of a crossover between sort of hippie freaks and easy listening vocal harmonies. And I think that the Carpenters were in a similar vein, but slightly more towards the pop side.
Neither of which immediately endears me to the music.
But no.
This is quite charming, though.
Well, the Carpenters get a bad press. And again, I'm a big Carpenters fan. And if you're not, listener, I recommend you go and Google Carpenters Help. And don't Google it, YouTube it, because it's an amazing
clip.
That sounds
like someone's going to come around my house with a hammer.
You might get some people with a hammer as well. But there's this amazing TV clip of Karen Carpenter singing and playing the drums, doing this incredibly funky cover of Help, which I've converted many a person to the Carpenters with. But this is a notch weirder, this particular track, because it's 2002, a hit song, which is obviously a tribute to 2001, A Space Odyssey. And it's their version of the KLF's manual, in that it's a description of how to make a hit record. So follow this and make a million.
Uniqueness is rule number one. No weakness to hinder the fun. Now sing it with reckless abandon. And go to the bank with your money. It's a hit.
Dedrick family, they're also known as the Free Design, with their 1969 effort 2002, a hit song, the second choice of today's guest music reviewer, Fred Deakin. that is completely insane, but it's also kind of its period in that that was the late 60s was when rock's sort of postmodern crisis actually began, because when people started to write rock songs about rock songs or about being in a rock band, it's the same period of The Byrds' So You Want to Be a Rock and Roll Star or Dr. Hook's The Cover of the Rolling Stone.
Yeah, you're right. It's an absolute postmodern meme. And I'm a sucker for anything like that. And, like, you know, things like XDC's go-to cover sleeve art is the visual version of that, where it says, you know, do not read this text. It's trying to make you buy this record. And then obviously at that point I have bought the record. You know, I'm totally sold.
What I find astonishing about that song is the fact that it has that, you know, the chirpy harmonies, and yet it has a big old hefty dose of cynicism throughout the entire thing. You know, we're going to make lots of money if you know, if we just sing this great song.
Yeah, it's totally surreal and incredibly funky and very melodious. I mean, it really moves me, that record, in a kind of juxtaposition, kind of contrast to the rather cynical lyric. But yeah, where did that come from? Where did that land from in space somewhere?
Was it actually a hit or anything close to being?
No. The Freedoms I never really made
perfect.
It commercially. So.
Any kind of junk shop story behind this one?
No. Just kind of flicking through racks, as I say. When I log certain bands, it's like I have to have everything. And then I weed through and find the good stuff, basically.
A touch of the OCDs, perhaps.
Exactly. Very possibly.
Fred, take us to the next one. Again, my head is being scratched. I don't know what this is about. This is about cars?
Yes, this is an album by the motoring company Chevrolet. And I found it in a junk shop in New York. And I think there was a kind of vogue for companies releasing albums. I've got one toothpaste album with Muhammad Ali on it telling you have to brush your teeth and various other... Obviously, you know, I had to buy it immediately. And it's great. And it turns out that it's Carly Simon singing on it in the background. So I'm not quite sure which track we've got on, but it's going to teach you how to drive safely, listeners.
Most everybody wants to drive a car.
But how many people really should?
It's for sure, not maybe, that a grown-up baby doesn't belong behind the wheel. And the boy who blows his top every time he has to stop can't drive on an even keel. The silly so-and-so who thinks he has to show how loud his tires squeal is just about as bad as the dull-witted lad who thinks every other driver is a heel.
When a hothead gets behind the wheel, he can be pretty dangerous.
And that's exactly why studies are being made on the behavior patterns of drivers.
It's for sure, not maybe, that a grown-up baby doesn't belong behind the wheel. And the boy who blows his top every time he has to stop can't drive on an even keel.
A song by the Chevrolet Motor Company there, encouraging people to drive safely. Fred Deakin, I'm not entirely sure how you can drive safely while listening to that in your car.
Well, exactly. The irony being, I think I would drive into a tree to make it stop.
Well, if you had a turntable in your car, then obviously it would be jumping all over the place.
The interesting things about your choices of music is that they force you to sit down and listen. Mm. They're not things that you can just enjoy in the background. Do you have a sort of a listening ritual? Or what do you do when you listen to music? Do you just sort of idly put something on and then go about your day? Or is this an active action?
Well, I think it should be active, really. I mean, I think that, again, that's kind of part of the experience that hasn't yet been worked out in the modern age. I spend a lot of time getting into music with my friends late at night, slightly fried, and playing each other records. And I think that experience is a very important experience where you share music socially and you kind of identify your tribe. And from what I can see, it's been replaced by people haggling over the YouTube window on a laptop and kind of, or people sitting on their own laptops with their headphones on. So that would be a very interesting place, I think, for music to evolve, and quite how it does it, I don't know.
But what do your friends say when you whack on a bit of Chevrolet?
Oh, they love it, you know. But you're absolutely right. It's very much an active listening experience. And I used to do an evening called the vinyl swap meet, where we'd come together and play each other records quite formally. And I think now that's sort of happening more in pubs. You see there's the odd evenings where you play the classic album and we'll sit around and listen to it from start to finish. So I think people are craving that kind of experience more and more.
Do you still DJ?
Yes, I do. I do. I'm actually playing at my sister's wedding tomorrow. So.
What are you? Well,
I will give you £5 to play Chevrolet Sings of Safe Driving and You.
Well, your money will be coming up your wallet very quickly. I mean, I've played Bernard Cribbins often. I've played John Denver in Fabric, which is one of my proudest moments. Sean Rowley of Guilty Pleasures was standing in the background. And I dropped Take Me Home Country Roads in the middle of the Fabric dance floor. Did clear the floor completely, but he did come up and shake my hand, saying, "You got balls, mate."
Did you actually manage to find anything out about this album? Because it's one of those records where, you bizarre and weirdly endearing as it is, I couldn't at least get out of my head the idea that the grown adults had meetings to make this happen, and at none of these meetings did anybody stick up their hand and go, "You're insane."
Yes, absolutely. Well, the thing is, there's the 70s equivalent of the YouTube movie, isn't it? In many ways, it's like they had to get their message out to the kids, and the kids love freaky hippie funk. And they're buying these albums, and we need to get them to drive safely because, you know, at that point, I think, when the cultural tipping point had been met.
Well, I would be riveted to know how many copies that actually sold.
Yeah, me too. Well, I mean, I'm hoping very few, in which case I'm hanging on to my rarity.
Speaking of kids, Fred, apologies if this is too personal a question, but every child hates their parents' music tastes.
Yes.
Every child is genetically programmed to do that, regardless as to what good taste you have. What have your children thought of your music taste as they've grown up?
I think there's a certain point when you find your own music taste, but my son is... he's in a band, you know. He plays music. He's very proactive about it. So I hope something of that has rubbed off on him. And I think he's welcomed. Johnny Cash was a big thing that we shared when he was younger, certainly. But yeah, at some point you go off, and I think you have to allow your children to find their own space. It's not fair. You have to be at some point. You say, okay, I need to hate what you're listening to, which is why Skrillex was invented. You know, for our generation who thinks they like every kind of music, and then actually, oh no, except that Skrillex stuff or whatever it is,
which is terrible. Of course, because we're from that generation. I'm afraid we have to say goodbye to you now, Fred. But before we do, could you introduce your final choice?
Well, this is
Bobby McFerrin.
It is indeed Bobby McFerrin, and I might take another fiver from you here, Andrew, because I mean, you might not think this would fill a dance floor.
It does. In fact, I've been one of those people on the dance floor.
Oh, well, there you go. The five has already gone to someone else. I'm too late. But yeah, this is a cracker. Bobby McFerrin with his a cappella version of Good Lovin'.
1, 2, 3. Good love. Good love. Good love. When I was feeling so bad, I asked my friend the doctor just what I had. I said, doctor, doctor, Mr. MD, doctor, could you please tell me what's ailing me? Doctor, he said, yeah, 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 yeah,
yeah, yeah, yeah, yeah, yeah, yeah, yeah.
All you need, all you really need, cause you gotta have love.
Good love.
All you need is love, good love, and baby,
good love.
She said, yeah, 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 yeah.
Yeah, 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 yeah.
All you need, all you really need. Come on, give me that.
Bobby McFerrin there, and Good Lovin', ending the choices of Fred Deakin, DJ. Chooser of the oddest music I think we could safely say we've ever had on Monocle 24.
It was pretty well up there, indeed. You are listening to The Review on Monocle 24. It's time now for our city look ahead, which takes on a different character today because we're not just looking at one city.
Summer is here in the Northern Hemisphere, and the outdoor cinema is becoming an increasingly popular trend in cities around the world. From the vast park of La Villette in Paris to the ever-so-intimate jacuzzi cinema here in London, it's the perfect solution for those wanting to enjoy film through the sunny months without being trapped in the cold dark of a cinema.
We scouted some of our favourite outdoor movie spots around the world, and Fernando Augusto Pacheco is here to guide us through them.
America is home of the drive-in theatre, and there's still some great spots to catch a screening on a Saturday night. Benji's in Baltimore has much to boast about. Not only do they claim to have the biggest screen in the whole of the US, 6,240 square feet to be exact, they've also been going for 57 years. There are a few rules. You have to have more than one person in your car if it's busy, and they only accept cash. But if you rock up tonight, you'll be able to see Going Attractions, which documents the history of the drive-in and its place in American culture over the last 60 years.
The drive-in sort of came out of this car culture, this time where we were trying to do everything in a car. And the drive-in kind of married Hollywood and cars, that post-war euphoria of optimism.
Or for something a bit more scenic, stateside, try Film on the Rocks in Denver. Screenings take place in the stunning Red Rocks Amphitheater. From mid-August, they'll be showing the Rocky Horror Picture Show.
It's astounding. Time is fleeting. Madness takes its toll.
Here in London, the Rooftop Film Club has teamed up with some of the best outdoor bars all around the city to screen classic films from east to west, north to south. We specially recommend a trip down to Peckham, where the roof of the Bussey building boasts 360-degree views of the city. Over the coming days there, you can catch Silver Linings Playbook, Amelie and Trance.
I know what you were going to do to me.
She put that memory there. It's not real.
It may be winter down under, but that's not putting off the people at Melbourne's Sun Pictures Cinema. Built in 1916, the outdoor picture garden says it's the oldest in the world, and it hasn't changed too dramatically since. Films are enjoyed while sitting in rows of deck chairs under the stars. The Great Gatsby, The Lone Ranger, and The Heat are all showing there over the coming days.
What is she doing?
She's looking for my balls.
Hey, if anyone's seen the captain's balls, let me know. They're about this big. They're like really, really tiny little girl balls. If little girls had balls.
And in Athens, the Cine Theseo is not one to miss. It's the city's oldest outdoor movie spot, with views of the Acropolis and Parthenon, to keep you entertained even if the screening doesn't. Show up before Wednesday and you can catch Hitchcock classic, The Birds.
I hardly think a few birds are going to bring about the end of the world. I think you're the cause of all this. I think you're evil!
They're coming, they're coming!
From Monaco, I'm Fernando Augusto Pacheco.
And you are listening to The Review on Monocle 24. We'll be back next to ask whether this year's Just for Laughs Montreal has indeed been Just for Laughs or Tumbleweed.
Surf's up this summer as Monocle Films follows the wind in search of an under-the-radar beach haven for diehard enthusiasts.
Ericeira is special for its wide array of waves. Beach breaks, point breaks, and reef breaks to suit a range of surfing styles and skill levels, all in a compact span of dramatic coastline. This 8-kilometer stretch of coast was named a World Surfing Reserve in 2011, and the surfers who come here can't stop raving about it.
Catch the wave in Ericeira in the film's menu on monocle.com.
Welcome back. It's Saturday here in London, so you must be listening to The Review with me, Emma Nelson and Andrew Muller. Now, if you've been listening to Robert Bound's Culture Show recently, you'll have heard his preview of 2013's Just for Laughs, the Montreal Comedy Festival, celebrating its 30th birthday.
The event is just about to wrap up, and I'm delighted to say we're joined now by comedian and comedy journalist James Mullinger, who is in Montreal to get his take on how things have gone this year. James, welcome to The Review.
Hi, how are you?
Very well. What have been your particular highlights of this year? Are there any trends discernible at a comedy festival the size of Just for Laughs?
I mean, the interesting thing is, of course, that every single year they basically have to top the last one, because every year they introduce a facet that impresses everyone and surprises everyone. And, of course, the following year, everyone wants another surprise, which is rather unfair given, you know, they are creating this incredible lineup year after year. I think the thing this year, and the thing that's impressed the industry and the public at large the most, is the strength of the female lineup. And you know, they've got every female comedian from Amy Schumer to Sarah Silverman to Joan Rivers here. And I think possibly the most interesting thing is the fact that they haven't made a big deal of this. This isn't a kind of a issue-based policy. It's not that they're trying to prove a feminist point. It's simply that a lot of the best comedians in the world right now happen to be female. That's definitely something that's been noticeable. also, you know, they're bringing Dave Chappelle here, who you know, obviously had an amazing TV show that everybody loves, but is kind of famously not necessarily difficult, but, you know, very hard to pin down. You know, he might not make a TV or live appearance for a couple of years, and yet he's doing, I believe, 9 shows in the space of a couple of days. And equally, Eddie Izzard is hosting a show and bringing to us stand-ups from all over the world. So I think that's the thing that this year is all about, is diversity.
The festival is, what, 30 years old now? It must have gone on quite a journey since its inception. Is it still the worldwide draw that it was, let's say, about 15, 20 years ago?
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. It's not more so. I mean, you know, 30 years ago, it was introducing Rowan Atkinson and Helen Page to the world. Of course, now they're just bringing more and more people to the festival to introduce to the public at large. What's interesting is, of course, you know, it has to function as a business. So there are flocks of people within Montreal and Canada and all over the world coming to buy tickets to watch shows, but equally it functions as this industry hub where deals are happening. You know, lots of comedians got their agent here, lots of people got their TV deals here, and that is still the case. That is still entirely relevant. People are signing DVD deals here, but at the same time, audiences are discovering people. I mean, there's a show called BritCom, which is, you know, the best of British stand-ups, and you know, a team of just fast people have come to the UK, gone across the country, and it's gone to the Edinburgh Festival and picked the acts that not only that they think are the best, but also the acts that they know that their audiences will enjoy the most. In essence, it is as relevant, if not more so.
How have your own shows gone? What's it like as a thing to play at?
Set list?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. To perform at the festival is obviously essentially nerve-wracking, because not only are you aware of the fact that you are being watched by your peers and by the kind of important people from the UK, but you are being watched by all over the, you know, promoters and agents from all over the world. So to be honest, it is nerve-wracking, but as with any gig, you are basically forced to kind of, you know, shut that, you know, push that aside and go, I just need to enjoy this, as opposed to focus on the limitations or indeed the prospects of a gig.
You had to do this amazing thing that happens at Just for Laughs, which is a comedy equivalent, I would imagine, of a bullfight, which is when you have to stand up and people give you one subject and you have to improvise off it. Tell us a little bit more about it and tell us what you did.
Yes, I mean, I'll be perfectly honest. I was nervous for weeks about this. It's a concept invented by a stand-up called Troy Conrad. And essentially, the comedian goes up on the stage and the subject, you know, appears on a screen behind them, and they have to do material about that subject. And the fascinating thing is, of course, you know, the people that are really great at it, like Jimmy Carr, do it seamlessly. They don't react to it. And if you go on YouTube, you'll see some comedians where the subject comes up and they kind of go, oh, no, or what can I do? And I hadn't done it before, and I was determined to do it well, like Jimmy Carr, which is the intention, which is that you actually seamlessly go through it as if it's your set list. In the same way a band has a set list, the words that pop up are like your reminders of what your material is about. And the fascinating thing about it is, of course, you know, you see comedians who have 20 years experience and are the best in the business, and you see them preparing for this terrified, because it is obviously absolutely nerve-wracking. You're taking away every kind of safety net that stand-up has. You know, all comedians spend, you know, months if not years honing material to make it perfect, and then suddenly you're taking all of that away. And it was absolutely bizarre doing it. I'll be honest, I was terrified, and, you know, especially doing it at Montreal, where, you know, the room is full of industry.
What did they give you to do?
Sorry?
What did you have to improvise on?
The fascinating thing is, a lot of people ask me that question the next day, and it's such an out-of-body experience. I actually couldn't remember the following day, but I'll give you some examples. One was Crucifix loyalty card. And you read Cruise as long as you can, and you just have to go with it. Another was Nipple Camp. And so literally that Nipple Camp comes up, and I launched into a bit on how Nipple Camp was a thing invented for kids who are obsessed with nipples. I mean, you just have to run with it. But as I say, at the time, you've no idea what's coming out of your mouth. You just have to hope for the best. But, you know, I was extremely surprised at how well it went. And it's such a buzz. You know, you do become addicted to it.
Are the audience at this event broad? Do they turn up being predisposed to be sympathetic, or do they look at it as a bit of a blood sport?
That's a very good point. Yeah, the audience are, you know, Paul Provenza, who compares and is, you know, the man behind the show, he explains it completely. So they're completely aware of what it's all about. He really kind of explains that this is what it's, you know, these are comedians that you might have seen before, but here they are doing this terrifying thing. In my case, it was my first time, and you know, a lot of comedians have done it many times, and I went to the show to check it out the night before. There was a couple of guys doing it for the first time, and he, you know, told the audience as such. On the night I was on, I said, "Oh, you're going to do the same for me?" And he said, yeah, don't worry, I'll tell them it's your first time. And he went up on stage to introduce me and said, "This next guy has done it a million times. He's one of the best." And I was to death. I froze. I was terrified. And I thought, "Oh my God, why is he doing that?" And then I thought, well, I'll go up and correct him. And then for whatever reason, I didn't. And I honestly think that it helped, because it meant that the audience were kind of on my side and primed to think that what I was saying was good, which kind of goes to prove the bizarre psychology of stand-up, that for some reason they were kind of on side as opposed to against, if you know what I mean.
I must ask you, James, having just heard what you've just recounted to us, I can't understand why on earth you'd ever want to do it. What is it that makes you stand up?
Honestly, I think, you know, you're absolutely right. I mean, this is the thing, right? Stand-up is difficult enough. Why make it harder? But it honestly is the challenge. And obviously, I mean, stand-up's enough of a challenge as it is. You know, there's very rarely a time that you go to do a gig, which is, you know, where you kind of go, well, that was easy and I didn't even need to think about it. But it was the biggest buzz of, you know, my stand-up career since probably doing my first ever gig. It was just beyond, I had no, because of course the thing is, you cannot prepare any other important or big or gig you're nervous about. You're reading your notes, you're thinking how you're going to deliver things, are they going to like this, are they going to like that. But this you cannot prepare for. I mean, you cannot physically predict what bizarre topics are going to appear. And it's an incredible buzz. But honestly, it's like an out-of-body experience in that the following day, I couldn't even remember, A, what the subjects were, or B, what I'd said. But when it works, it's a hell of a thrill.
James Mullinger, thank you so much for joining us. If you're headed to Montreal, you still have time to catch the last 2 days of Just for Laughs, which wraps up on Sunday night.
And that brings us to the end of our Saturday review for now. It's goodbye from all of us here at Midori House. Our show today was produced by Katie Bilbao and Fernanda Augusto Pacheco. Our researcher was Gaia Lutz, and our studio manager was Claire Urban.
We're handing back over to Georgina with the Weekend Edition next, where you can catch our pick of the week's best Monocle 24 stories. And don't forget to tune in to the Monocle Weekly, which will be on air on Sunday at midday London time with Andrew Tuck and Robert Bound.
But in the meantime, you've been listening to The Review with me, Emma Nelson.
And me, Andrew Muller. Goodbye. Thanks for listening. Have a good weekend.
Bye-bye.